It is time to bring in Tim Luke and Greg Strom, the frickin' frack of Nick and Knack with Appraise This. You'll always be able to find them on the web at tqag.com, but right here on Robinhood Radio. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Nice to speak to you guys this weekend. I have one thing to start off with, and this is how dumb I am, guys, about auction. Last night, in the evening before we're going to do this, I scanned to see if there's anything that I might know something about, okay, and be able to converse with you on a halfway decent level. And I saw an article, a headline on a Schroeder auction, and I took Schroeder as being a different Schroeder. So I click on the story, and I see that the Schroeder toy collection at Bertoia's, part one, over $3 million.
Yes. You know what, Marshall? We're on the same wavelength because I have that article right up right now, too. I was going to talk about that. Yes. Actually, that Schroeder, they were in the music business. It was Abby and her husband. Aaron Schroeder, Aaron Schroeder was a songwriter, music industry mogul, and then his business partner and fellow collector, his wife, Abby, it was their collection. And what's interesting about this collection is that Greg and I had an opportunity to meet Abby, when we were up in Connecticut. Actually, we were doing, the fundraiser up there. And we were staying at our friends in our friend Tim's, and he had hosted a party, and Jeannie Bertoia was there, and Abby just happened to be in town, and so Greg was the chef, and Greg prepared the meal that evening, and it was nice because we were talking to her about the collection and possibly selling and what was going on, and that, my goodness, that had to have been 5 years ago. So,
and I'm sure. And I'm sure that's why they sold so well, was because of that meal.
That's right. I'm sure it was. Well, the decision, anyway, to sell with Bertoia. But this collection, and just the background, is that they were, the two of them were major collectors. And they collected the mechanical banks, the cast iron mechanical banks, early American toys, and the collection itself was just really a world-class collection because they really collected rare examples. They traded up. They started slow, and then just like most collections, they amassed it over a lifetime. And then Bertoia ended up selling this, which was the right place for it to sell. But there were some really, really great prices. There was a girl skipping rope, which is what you would think. It's a wind-up, but it's a cast iron mechanical bank that has a girl that when you release the lever, she's supposed to jump rope. And this was estimated, I think, at $80,000 to $100,000, and that particular piece broke a record for the girl skipping rope. It sold for $156,000, which, partly here again, it comes down to condition, because the condition was really great, but also provenance, because of where the piece is coming from and who owned this particular collection.
I have a question. I don't remember if their girl skipping rope, was that part of the, did he buy that from the Saks, the Stan Saks sale? Because that was at that time, the girl skipping rope, That was a record.
Yes.
You know,
I don't believe so.
I look at the story, Tim and Greg, and it brings back memories, because when I was a kid, my grandmother and my mother and dad, we used to be given back in the 50s these mechanical banks, these small things. And I look at these. By the way, this website I'm looking at, Live Auctioneers, the pictures are absolutely astounding of some of these gadgets and how they work, and also the humor that goes into some of them as well. It really, yes. You know, I forget how incredible these things were for their time.
Right.
Yeah. Mechanical banks have always been something that people have been really intrigued with. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's the technology of that time period, and the fact that it was only a penny. You know, you would put a penny in there, and the idea was to treat or to teach kids how to save money. So it was a great idea, which turned out to be a terrific piece of Americana. And there was a, in the heyday of mechanical banks, there were a handful of collectors who collected only the best pieces, and some of them hadn't been seen in these collections for years and years and years. And that's what, and we've talked about this in the past, what drives the market is something that is in really remarkable condition, original shape, original condition, original paint. And when they do finally come on the market, depending on who they belong to, that also puts credibility behind the piece, which also drives the market. So this was really a great sale, and I'm not sure when the next portion of the sale is going to be.
But probably will be in the fall, because they'll spread it out. But one of the other mechanical banks that is it's very rare. I've never really seen it. Was the Breadwinners?
That's one of my favorite. That picture of Breadwinners is not only a mechanic, but it's a politicized one as well.
Yes. And that was some of the things that the mechanical banks really they criticized, or it was about politics. It was about some religion, because there's a Jonah and the Whale bank as well. So it was about helping teach not only thrift but also these statements. And this Breadwinners Bank, I've never seen. And so this is, and that sold for over $100,000. It was $102,000, which was, it's just wonderful. And then the Harlequin, the clown Harlequin and Columbine cast iron bank, and that sold for $84,000. And that's always been one of my favorites, just for, you know, how the way it looks, and the way cast iron can look so elegant. It's just amazing for some of these toys, and the age of them as well, and the condition. And I think that this is great. And in the article, Greg, to your question, the next group of these toys will be sold in September. And then another in the spring of 2022. So it was a rather large collection of just these rare, wonderful items. And that was the cast iron banks. And then also in cast iron, Ives Toys Maker, they were an early American toy maker. They did a lot in cast iron, but they then went on to do trains. And there was a bicycle. It was a Ives Bicyclist Team pull toy, which, again, one that you've never seen. It's really an exceedingly rare piece, is that it just was beautiful. And that piece, that sold for $36,000, which was almost four times the estimate. So just amazing stuff. And what it shows is that and we always say this, it doesn't matter what's going on in the economy, good stuff always sells. It's the good stuff, rarity, desirability, and having the provenance that also makes a big difference when it comes to auction.
I want to go on to another article, because we've touched upon it before, and in our area, people were exposed to this almost 2 years ago when the museum up in Pittsfield decided to sell some very, very famous paintings to put money back into their museum. And there's an article that more and more museums are taking advantage of a rule that was set up during the pandemic, and they are putting things on the auction block. And the New York Historical Society is one of those. They're putting a painter's on the block, flags on 57th Street, estimated at $12 to $18 million, and they can do this because of the rule that was set up where they can put the money to. I was wondering, as an auctioneer and as someone who sees art, has been around art, and sees the art also when you and Greg go to the different museums on your own doing personal thing, what your feeling is about what is going on so these museums can survive.
Yeah. You know, that's certainly a double-edged sword. It really is. You understand and have empathy with museums because of what's happened during... A lot of museums before the pandemic were having difficulty, but when the pandemic hit, oh my God, it was just like somebody turned the water off and things just dried up. And you really have to feel for these museums, but you know, there are pros and cons. And if you look at it strictly from the thought process that, okay, well, these items, although we appreciate having them in our collection, do they really meet the scope of what our belief in having this museum represents? So that's where it gets a little touchy, because a lot of times people who donated to the museums, you know, we're not talking about entire collections. We're talking about a handful of higher priced or higher valued items that a museum needs to stay alive. So, you know, it's definitely damned if you do and damned if you don't. So I'm not really quite sure where the happy medium is, but you have to feel sorry for these museums, because they have to stay open, because it's what's in their museum that people pay to go see. And if they end up going to the museum and there's nothing on the walls, then, you know, what's the point? So you have to look at both sides, and I just would not want to make the decision of trying to sell something off just to keep the doors open or make payroll. Or I think there are specific rules, though, that dictate yes. what they can be sold, what can be sold, and what the process is going to have to be. But even so, there are always going to be people on both sides saying, no, you shouldn't have sold it. Yes, you should have sold it. So it's rough. And the pandemic, I will say, has brought out a lot of these issues, and I just hope that it can be worked out so that it's equitable on both sides. Because if we lose our cultural heritage of the amassed art in this country, I think it hurts civilization as a whole.
Well, and I would agree, Greg, is that there is a delicate balance, but if if everyone gets fired and no one's there to take care of the collection because yeah. there's no money yeah. to pay for that, then, you know, again, that delicate balance. And the particular painting, Marshall, that you're talking about is going up at Sotheby's, and that's going to be sold in May. And it's part of other offerings that they're having. But there are six other institutions mm-hmm. that also are have items in that particular sale. And it is that temporary loosening of the deaccessioning regulations. And apparently we are about halfway through the 2-year window that is allowing this, so that these institutions can continue to take care of the collection. Because at the end of the day, that is what the individuals who gave these things, hoping that these institutions would always be there, but not realizing or not factoring in that there can be extenuating circumstances, unintended pandemics, things that you, unintended consequences that you just don't realize. And those things do come up. And I think that we have to look at that, objectively, but also with the understanding that this is being done not just to sell, but to help maintain the rest of the collection and to maintain the institutions themselves. And I don't think that we're seeing a massive sell-off. I think that there are some things they do have to, they have to come to terms with, and hopefully that will bring in other donations of other great things that they can add to the collection as they fight to stay alive, basically.
All right, one final story that I saw, and it's about an artist, Robert Colescott is his name. He has a satire painting, Washington Crossing the Delaware. It's not George Washington, of course, it's Washington Carver. And you talk about a political statement, and you talk about satire. But this painting, this artist has never had anything go for more than $900,000. This painting right now is estimated to go for $9 to $12 million.
My goodness. I'll have to look him up because I'm not familiar with him.
No, but and if you look at a picture of the painting, it is definitely satire, but it's caustic, and I think it'll affect. This is the great thing about art: two people can look at it and view it totally different. And it takes on a statement of history, which is Washington crossing the Delaware, and then moving it into George Washington Carver and Black America. And it really is. I don't know if you guys had a chance to look it up online yet, but it's one of those things that exemplifies to me what art is. Which to me, this picture kind of upsets me a little bit. I don't know whether the artist is black or white or not, but. To get this much money on a painting that is a satire, to me, is absolutely amazing.
Well, I haven't actually seen the painting, I don't really know anything about the artist. But that's, you know, you hit on something about, and that is how art affects everybody, and it's. As you say, two people can look at something and have a totally different take on it. A good example is Tim and I. I forget where it was we were in, and there was a huge canvas on the wall, and it was nothing. It was painted white. That was it. It took up an entire wall. It was all that was on the painting. And I said to Tim, okay. I give up. What is this? He said, oh, well, you know, this, you know, let's look at it and let's see about who the artist is. But it was, to me, it was absolutely ridiculous. But then again, it was in this collection that was totally amazing by this artist. And I forget what it eventually or what it originally had sold for, but it was literally like a 6-foot by 6-foot canvas that was, there was not anything on it. It was just hanging on the wall with just the base coat on it. Do you remember that, Tim?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yep. It's like, okay, where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line?
Right.
And
What I was going to say is that for this particular painting, it's... and especially to be estimated at $9 million to $12 million for an artist that, you know, this will be a record. And I see the photograph, and yes, you summed it up, Marshall, is that this is what art does, is that this pushes buttons, there's a variety of things in the way that it will evoke these different emotions. But this particular artist, he died in 2009, and the work is being sold from a private Midwest, it's a private holding, And it's been exhibited all over, and it's going to be exhibited all over. It's been on display in a variety of different museums around the world, actually, and it will continue to be on display until it makes its way back to New York, and I think that's when it'll be sold, is later in May. The piece will be sold, so it'll be interesting to see what this sells for, because I think it's currently on view in Hong Kong until April 21st, and then it travels to Los Angeles, and then the final destination is New York in May. So
I just saw it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just pulled it up online. I'm gobsmacked. It can be taken there again. Two people could take this totally differently.
I understand it. It makes a terrific political statement and satire, but it also evokes other feelings. And I think that's the great. I guess that's the great thing about art: the feelings that it evokes. Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, when you look at it, it hits every derogatory stereotype of the African American that we in this country are, you know, growing up, a lot of us never really even thought about. But now with everything that's happening in the current political situation, man, this is really could be considered extremely offensive or extremely genius.
It's art. I guess that's what art's supposed to do, really, when you come right down to it. So
yeah, well, and the artist himself, he studied with Leger, so it's interesting, and he's known for this satirical genre and crowd subjects, and it also says here bitter reflections on being African American, and you know that is what he's putting out there, and I think that again. It'll be interesting to watch how the market reacts to this and what its final selling price will be.
All right. Well, interesting morning this morning, guys. I want you to have a good week.
Very much so.
We'll speak to you next week.
Hey, have a great
week. Take care, Marshall.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Tim Luke and Greg Strom answering some of my questions this morning here on Appraise This. You'll find them at tqag.com on the web.